Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Is this too dressy? Is Southern Lady code for, I look fabulous and it would be in your best interest to tell me so? I'm not crazy about it is code for, I hate that more than sugar-free punch. What do you think about her is code for, I don't like her. She's always been lovely to me is code for, I don't like her either. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Those were not my words that you just heard, but quotes from Helen Ellis's new collection of short stories. That one was called Southern Lady Code. Ellis herself is a daughter of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, transplanted to Manhattan's Upper East Side, where she lives and writes and entertains when she is not, and this is true, winning hands in World Series of Poker tournaments in Las Vegas. Clearly, this is someone we need to know more about. You can learn something about her taste for black comedy by reading her new collection of short stories, American Housewife, and she'll be at the Dallas Museum of Art Friday evening for Arts and Letters Live. She joins us now to talk about her work and her life. Helen Ellis, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
You call yourself a housewife, and your characters here are housewives. Is there something about that term which frankly feels sort of quaint these days that appeals to you?
Well, I myself am kind of quaint. You know, it's so funny. I keep hearing that this is sort of a reclaiming of the word housewife, and I never let the word go. Even when I wasn't a housewife, it was never a dirty word in my book. So there you have it. I am what I am.
Well, it's interesting in this sort of post-Betty Friedan world, right, where we assume mm-hmm. that being a housewife would be a choice rather than an assumption or something thrust upon you.
It is a choice. That is true. You can be a housewife and a feminist. I am both, and the reason I am both is because, A, it's a choice to be a housewife, and B, I'm a feminist because I don't feel a need to explain my choice.
I think lots of people in your position might have the same household responsibilities and choose to remind people that, well, I'm actually a writer. I just happen to be home during the day.
You know, as you said earlier, I'm a card player, and I am someone who keeps my cards pretty close to my Playtex 48-hour bra.
You write about a bra fitter who is like the object of every woman's desire, not for himself, but for what he can do for them.
Yes, he is pilgrimage worthy. The fitter comes from the fact that there are fitters out there. I have a fitter. Her name is Cynthia on the Upper East Side. And I had heard tell of a Hasidic Jewish man on Orchard Street who is a fitter and, of course, does not touch the women he fits. He has women who help him do the fittings. And I thought to myself, what would it be like to be married to a fitter and to do the fitting yourself? And I thought, I would be terribly jealous.
And it's fascinating because he is treated almost like an oracle.
Yes, he is. People come from all over the country. He has a gift. As it says in the story, once you're in the right bra, you can tell you're in the right bra if you hop. And if you hop, you know, your breasts should stay in place. And every woman, no matter what age you are, if you hop, you are a 16-year-old girl.
I have to wonder if there's any woman who has read this collection of stories and came to that passage and didn't give it a try.
Are you hopping right now?
I don't want to get out of breath while I'm here on the radio, but I might have to try it later.
It's fun to hop.
So you grew up in Alabama.
Yes, Roll Tide.
Right. And what yes. what do people think about Alabama that may or may not be true?
I don't want to. I'm trying not to censor myself. I think they. It's the same sort of situation where someone hears I'm from Alabama or someone hears me say I'm a housewife and they make the judgment that there's not much to me. And again, I'm at an age in my life where you can think whatever you would like to think about me. I know who I am and I know what it is to be from the South, what it is to be a housewife. And both are quiet, lovely existences.
I think people make some of the same assumptions about Texas, and it, you just can't paint a whole state with such a broad brush.
Not everybody has a gun in their medicine cabinet.
Do you feel like you absorbed assumptions when you lived in Alabama about things like social class and propriety and gender roles? And how much did you sort of take them as a prescription for what to do? And how much did you buck against them?
I bucked hard against them. I wrote a novel that was published in 2000 called Eating the Cheshire Cat, and it was about revenge sought on the University of Alabama homecoming queen. And the book was about three young women from the age 12 to 22, and it was a very anti-marriage book. Marriage was seen as a trap, and small-town Southern life was seen as a trap. And in the years since, 15 years since that book, I have found great comfort, great solace, and great freedom in being a housewife, being in a happy marriage. And I do appreciate the South. I'm really looking forward to coming down for a visit.
Were you a kid who couldn't wait to move to the city?
I was out of there at 17. Mm-hmm. Yes. But I wonder, I would think it's not particularly a Southern instinct. I think everybody wants to get out of the town that they're in, even New Yorkers. You know, I know many a person who was raised in New York City who wants to go the wilds of Iowa. It's always, you know, the grass is greener in the other person's yard.
It's always fascinating to me, too, when you go somewhere that is really different from the place you're from, it can mm-hmm. kind of intensify, like in your case, maybe your Southern sensibility, because people perceive you in a certain way that would probably pass notice if you were, still in Alabama.
Well, I tell you, I just ran into someone who I admire, and I said, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, are you the one that wrote that book? And I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, how old are you? And I said, I am 45. And she says, you don't have to say ma'am anymore. But that is just good manners. But in Manhattan, like you say, well, not like you say, like I say, a ma'am in Manhattan is like a dirty bomb. Nobody knows what to make of it. Whereas I cling to those manners.
Yeah. I was thinking, too, about, and maybe it's unique to New Orleans, but with a lot of people that I have known from there, they love this place they're from. They talk about it all the time, yet they don't live there. And so they build their identity in another city around being from New Orleans, which is unlike anywhere else in America.
Well, I have been in Manhattan for over 20 years. I've been here longer than I was ever in the South, but I will always remain a Southern lady. I mean, the accent doesn't hurt, but I can't imagine ever dropping it.
Did you, before you left, did you even realize that you had an accent? Because I think even by Texas standards, I could hear it, but it's not honey thick, you know. It's relatively
Thank
subtle.
You. Well, you know, if you give me one drink or make me very angry, you will hear it. My husband definitely hears it. Once he came home for the first time, and we were meeting friends, and he takes me aside and says, Helen, do you people eat bear? And I said, what? And I said, so-and-so asked me if I wanted to go have some bear. And I said, he said beer. So, you know, that and an aspic salad. Really stumped him.
In your story, Dumpster Diving with the Stars, you have this character who's a novelist. Her only book was published 15 years previously. So in the interest
Sound familiar?
In the interest of reviving her career, she goes on this reality show where the job is, I guess, to find a bunch of junk and see how much it's going to be worth. Where did the idea come from? Were you watching TV and thinking, I could do that? Or
Well, I was watching TV, as I tend to do, and I enjoy a reality show. I love Dancing with the Stars. I love American Pickers. And it was sort of a combination of the two. But I remember every time I watch a reality show, I think, why aren't there any authors on these shows? I still can't think of one. You know, why isn't Stephen King Dancing with the Stars? Why isn't, you know, Anne Rice in The Amazing Race eating a big bag of worms? You know, why are these things not happening? And I thought, well, what would happen if a washed-up writer went on to a reality show to revive her career? I wonder where that idea came from.
You quit writing for a while.
I did. You know, I had a book come out in 2000, which did very well. And then I wrote another book about a serial killer that did not find a publisher. And then I wrote a book about a 19th century prostitute in New Orleans and that did not find a publisher. And then I wrote a book about a witch who infects her 1950s neighborhood with herpes. And believe it or not, that did not sell. And I thought, well, you know, I wonder what will happen if I just stop writing. And what happens is you put on 20 pounds, well, 15, and nobody cares. So there were probably a good two and a half years where I didn't write a thing.
I was thinking about that because I don't want to assume that you have ever suffered from imposter syndrome, but if I were in your position, I would worry.
What does that mean?
Imposter syndrome? It's when you think that everyone thinks I'm so successful, but I know that I'm really a fraud.
Oh, no, I don't think that.
No, well, that's what I mean. Like, I can see how, no, I don't think that now, but I can see how if you'd had a novel that you know, out of the gate, your first novel did really well and was critically mm-hmm. acclaimed, and then the next projects you worked on and poured your heart and soul into mm-hmm. didn't do as well, it would do a number on your confidence.
It did. It did a number on me, that's for sure. Fortunately, I had the solace of poker, another life to sort of throw myself into. And I had a very happy life as a housewife to throw myself into. And I threw myself hard and had a very soft landing. And then I couldn't stay away, I guess. Every time I would go to a party or a grocery store or a cosmetic counter and someone would say, "What do you do?" And I would say, "I'm a housewife." They would say, "What do you do all day?" And I started an anonymous Twitter account called What I Do All Day to sort of explain it and to get my voice back. And I will tell you that thanks to Twitter, here I am.
Did you feel like you could like embrace Twitter from the beginning, or did it take a while to find the voice that worked for you on Twitter?
It took a while. And I tell you, Twitter is a very good editor. I still to this day tweet from that account. And if a tweet is not retweeted, it's deleted in the first 20 minutes. I like a very clean stream. And when you have a stream of tweets that have been retweeted, you know, 20, 30 times, when you, Chris, you know, come over to look at the feed, you'll just see the strongest tweets. So it really did work as an editor.
Are there things that you put out there not knowing if they would resonate, and have you been surprised about some of the things that people really pick up on?
Yes, absolutely. Two things. I'll tell you something very recently. Last week I tweeted, because I do live tweet The Bachelor, because who doesn't? If it's good enough for Jennifer Weiner and Peter Strobe, it's good enough for me. And I tweeted, "Why isn't The Bachelor called Chardonnay Showdown? I think it should be called Chardonnay Showdown." And that was retweeted hundreds of times. But that was the most popular tweet since years ago. There was a Super Bowl. And I could not tell you who was playing in the Super Bowl, but the halftime act was Beyonce. And the next morning I tweeted, "Inspired by Beyonce, I stallion walked to the toaster." And that gained me hundreds of followers. And I thought to myself, well, if I ever write a book, that's going to be the first line. And that is the first line.
My guest is author Helen Ellis. Her new short story collection is called American Housewife. She will be in town on Friday for Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you would like to join our conversation now, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Helen Ellis, whose short story collection is called American Housewife. Helen Ellis will be in Dallas at the DMA on Friday for Arts and Letters Live. If you'd like to join our conversation now, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So you mentioned just before the break, Helen, that great first line, inspired by Beyonce, I stallion walked the toaster. That's from a little a story or an essay called What I Do All Day. You, or the character you've written, describes feigning interest in many different subjects of cocktail party talk. And I love the passage. You talk about feigning interest in skiing, golf, politics, religion, owl collections, shell collections, charity benefits, school fundraisers, green juice, the return of 80s step class, 90s grunge, bridge clubs, ping pong mania. It perfectly describes a certain kind of lovely but very polite and restrained party that we have all attended.
Yes.
So was that a party? That's a party that you gave, or a party that you attended, or just a sort of amalgamation of parties in general?
Every party. That's every party. You know, and another piece, How to Be a Grown-Ass Lady, I say if someone says something that you don't find appealing, you say, that's interesting. And if somebody says something you do find appealing, you say, that's interesting. So I do a lot of that at parties. That's interesting. And yeah, I throw a lot of parties and I go to a lot of parties and that is sort of what it is. What I do all day was sort of the happy Mrs. Dalloway.
Is there a place that you go, a situation you find yourself in, where you can sort of remove the cloak of politeness?
Yes, a poker tournament. I play probably every other month. I play in a poker tournament around the country, and it's the poker table tournaments especially where I feel my most natural self. I can be confrontational. I can be vicious. I can be sly and never say a word, never be rude, act like a lady, but play like a shark. And it's very natural to me. Whereas in the rest of my life, I mind my manners.
How did you get good at poker?
I'm still getting good at poker. I learned to play poker when I was 6 years old at the table of my granddaddy and my papa beside me teach me how to play seven-card stud. And I come from a line of men who never let you win. And I learned then when I was 21, my father met me in Las Vegas. We went to see Siegfried and Roy when they were new and all in there all together. And the Mirage was new and had the volcano erupting outside. And we played, and then Papa walked me out to the strip and sat me down on Caesar's statue and said, look around. And I looked around, and there were all the lights of Las Vegas, and in the sky were all the lights of the stars. And he said, Helen Michelle, this is the center of the universe. And ever since, I meet him twice a year to play in tournaments. Usually at this time of year, I'm down in Biloxi, Mississippi at the Beau Rivage playing the Southern Poker Championship. I am pretty happy to be missing it this year, but he is there and he's doing pretty good.
So if you don't do well, are you like on top of everything thinking, I'm letting my dad down?
No, I've done pretty good. And that's the thing about poker that helps with, I think, regular life and the writing life. I heard once before that if you cash in 10% of the poker tournaments you play, you're doing great. So that's the thing. You lose, and you lose a lot when it comes to poker tournaments, because a poker tournament can last anywhere from 4 hours to 5 days, and you have to be the last one standing. And you're just not always going to be the last one standing. I've only been the last one standing once. But you learn to take it on the chin, and you know that there's another tournament around the corner, just like when I was submitting these stories to lit mags and I would get rejections, it didn't hurt at all. The New Yorker rejected me for every single story, and it didn't hurt at all because I knew there was somebody else out there who might pull it from the slush, and that's what happened. So it makes makes you a little fearless, all the failing.
That's really interesting to me. It's hard to imagine not being emotional about, you know, stories that you've worked on being rejected, although I guess you sort of understand that's part of the process. It's really hard for me to imagine not being emotional about losing money. I see people in these tournaments and they just stay so calm and they're
me.
So polite.
Yes. Well, not always. But believe me, I get upset. You know, I definitely get upset. Nobody likes to lose, but it's easier to let it go. Usually when I bust out of a tournament, I'm upset for about an hour. Whereas years ago, when I busted out of a tournament, I would be upset for 2 days. So with the writing and writing the short stories, after I had, you know, toiled away on novels for 6 years at a time that were rejected and then given up, and then to write the short stories, when they would get rejected, it just didn't sting as much. And when they would get plucked from the slush, it gave me hope. So, you know, when you've been down, it's you know, it just doesn't hurt as much to get pinched.
I love this like vocabulary that you're using. Like plucked from the slush sounds like something that you could say aside from, you know, flopped on the river or whatever the expression is.
Yes. There's a lot of good poker language. When I talk about being in a tournament to my friends who do not play, which are most of my friends, they say, "I don't know what you are saying, but it sounds very exciting."
When you started writing again, did you avoid telling people about it? Was it like, you know, a New Year's resolution that you keep to yourself in case it doesn't happen?
You are the first one to ask me that. And I did. When I started the Twitter account, I did not tell my husband until I had 100 followers. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting down with him to say, "Okay, I have something to tell you." And all color draining from his face. And then finding out that I had started a Twitter account. And he says, "Please don't lay anything on me like that in the future. And you would have killed me if I sat down with you and told you like that." So I didn't tell anyone. And when I sold the collection, when Doubleday bought the collection, people in my life did not know I was publishing short stories. Only a handful knew. Because they've been published over, most of them have been published over 2 years here and there in literary magazines, which now they are easier to find online. I think a lot of colleges are putting the work online, but not everyone had gone to seek those out. So I even kept that pretty much to myself. Really only my book club knew that I was doing it.
Are you in the kind of book club where people actually read the book?
Yes, well, most of us do. I am in a classic trashy book club, which means that the book has to be at least 20 years old, mm-hmm. Usually made into a made-for-TV miniseries or banned or called, you know, chicklet or erotica. So the very first one we read a few years ago was Scruples by Judith Krantz. We've read Lace. We just read The World is Full of Married Men by Jackie Collins, Wifey by Judy Blume. That's a novel those are novels that are pretty easy to, you know, as my girlfriend would say, suck up like a milkshake. They're delightful.
So what do you see as the purpose of book clubs?
The purpose of book club is drinking. And it's drinking. It's sitting down with a group of friends once a month. And it's for us, what I like about our book club is that it's reaching back to books that haven't been on the bestseller list or been out there for years and years. And strangely enough, with my book club, I am the only real Luddite in the bunch, so if the book is not available on ebook, we don't pick the book. Whereas I go to the library up into the stacks and pull down, you know, Flowers in the Attic. If it's not on the ebook, then they won't order it. So I really wanted to read Hollywood Wives, but Hollywood Wives is not on on an ebook. So The World is Full of Married Buzz. And it was very good. Swinging 60s in London.
There probably aren't garage sales in your neighborhood, but in my neighborhood, you could pick all those up for about a dime a piece.
Yes, I keep trying to push The Other Side of Midnight by Sidney Sheldon because I pulled that book out of a garage sale, on some travel or other.
So when you write a collection of short stories, and these are very short stories and just, you know, mm-hmm. so compactly told, and there's so much, you know, nuance in them, there's not just the editing that goes into each one to sort of craft it, but there are these decisions about which ones to publish. Can mm-hmm. you talk about how that worked for you and how you thought about the flow and the order in which they would you know, appear in the book and the way that they relate to one another, even though ostensibly they're all different?
They are all different. It's definitely not linked short stories. The thing they have in common is the fact that each narrator is a housewife. But the stories were rearranged many, many times. What I Do All Day was always number one. And then the thought was, okay, if a reader can get through the wainscoting war and like it, then you might like the rest of the book. Because some of the stories are as, how can I put this nicely, dark. Some of them are very dark. So I tried to balance, we tried to balance dark stories with funny stories, Southern stories with New York stories, because while there are real good Southern stories like The Fitter and Southern Lady, there are particular New York stories like The Wainscoting War and Dead Doorman.
Dead Doorman was really fascinating. I don't know what I expected given the title, but it still sort of packs a punch at the end. We set it up for us just a little bit. We don't necessarily have to spoil it.
Dead Doorman is about a woman who is confined to her Upper East Side apartment. You would think that she is under the thumb of her husband or her mother-in-law, and in fact, her house is haunted. So you're wondering the whole time, is it the husband? Is it the mother-in-law? Is it the ghosts that are the monsters? And in fact, the narrator herself, in my opinion, is the monster.
And I had questions about whether her choices made her that kind of monster or whether she was a victim of, you know, what other people wanted from her.
I think that the mother-in-law is that kind of monster and saw in her a seed. You know how they have a bad seed.
Yeah.
and groomed her. I think it took a long time for the mother-in-law's son to find a match that she would approve of. And when she found this narrator, she could entrust her apartment to the narrator, because I think the mother-in-law loves the apartment and the co-op more than her own child, who's a, you know, 50-something-year-old man. But you'll always be your mama's baby.
Right. It also made me think of the fact that, you know, so often wretchedly unhappy people mm-hmm. won't rest until they have made someone else wretchedly unhappy.
I think that's true.
Who in your personal life do you not want to read your stories?
I don't care.
You don't care? There's nobody that
No, I don't. I really don't. My husband has said on more than one occasion, what are the neighbors going to think when they read it? Because we do live in a co-op apartment. I am wondering what my doorman will think. But
are you pro or anti-wainscoting?
I am anti-wainscoting. That is a very cathartic story. But really, I wrote the stories with the thought of just entertaining myself. After having not published for so long, I'm really in shock that anybody, including you, have read these stories. And I'm at the point in my life where I really don't mind what you think of me or what you think of the work. So have at it. Anybody can read it.
What does it feel like to have people, if you're being sincere, if you really don't care what anybody thinks
and
you're writing
don't.
For yourself, I mean, is that, that's a new thing for you?
That is a new thing. It really is. I think that goes along with just being an old, a older woman and, you know, older than 20-something. I am, I think, smack dab in the middle of middle age at 45, and I'm very happy to be at that age. And I, up until this point, have lived a really private life for many years. And I really think after the book comes and goes, I'll just go back to my private life.
It does seem like, you know, there are things that you and I have talked about that I know you've talked mm-hmm. about elsewhere. Do you consciously or unconsciously kind of make decisions about, okay, I'll talk about the poker, I'll talk about my dad, I'll talk about, you know, how I got back to writing. Are there things that you are able to stay away from in these interviews, which, you know, can be pretty invasive when you're really wanting to talk about your work and somebody else wants to find out about you as a human being?
Nobody's asked me anything that I haven't wanted to answer up until this point. I really don't mind. There's just really nothing yet, unless you have my FBI file.
No. I have nothing to spring on you. I do find it very refreshing that you admit to watching trashy TV now and then.
Of course I do. Of course. I'm looking forward to, The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills tonight. I'm taping it. So, I love it. But I also like Downton Abbey. I am a very lady.
Do you fight against, you know, some of your characters write about, you know, what they do all day and the ways that they're taking care of the house? I would think if I were trying to sit down and write at any length, it would be so easy to think, oh, my gosh, I have got to, you know, take those smudge marks off the refrigerator with some olive oil.
That's a good trip. I'm going to write that down.
Yeah, it actually works better than cleanser.
Ooh. Yeah. Ooh, I love it. I'm gonna use that. A lot of the times I leave the house. I go to the library or I used to have a writer's space. A lot of the times I will leave the house and put the computer on Mac Freedom for 2 hours at a time. Because when I'm in my house, I will sit there and say, oy, 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 those baseboards need to be cleaned.
Right. We're speaking this hour with author Helen Ellis. Her new short story collection is called American Housewife, and she will be in Dallas on Friday evening at the DMA for Arts and Letters Live. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Helen Ellis about her new short story collection, American Housewife. You can see her Friday at the Dallas Museum of Art for Arts and Letters Live. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org. You have a story, the last story in the collection, and it's called My Novel is Brought to You by the Good People at Tampax. It seems to be sort of an exploration of maybe the trade-offs you think you have to make to get published. Not you, but one at a certain phase in one's career.
I think so. The publishing world has changed since I published a book 15 years ago. There was really no internet happening back then, and now everybody wants authors to tweet and Instagram and Facebook and Snapchat and hoo-ha and whatever, we're supposed to do. And I think writers can get easily distracted from the writing or think that tweeting, well, what can I say, is the writing. I know I can. And so I, My novel is brought to you by the good people at Tampax. I just thought to myself, what would happen if a novelist signed a contract with a corporate devil, so to speak? And that's what happens. I noticed that you guys are sponsored by Kotex.
Yes, and Depends and Huggies, yes.
Yes.
We're not above that.
That's right.
They're underwriters. I know.
Why is Tampax not sending me on my book tour?
I don't know. Well, you know, it's funny because obviously the piece is satirical, and yet I would imagine there are many writers out there who would make that sort of deal with the devil if they could get some exposure.
Well, you think about the movies and television with product placement. You see a Coca-Cola can and am reaching far back, E.T. Or you see lately on television, especially, I remember when the iPad came out, it was on Modern Family, and then you see Star Wars come out, and it was on The Big Bang Theory. You know, there's all that cross-promotion and product placement going on, and I am surprised that we have not seen that in novel form yet.
What do you make of the divisions or the dissolving of the divisions between different media, right? So you're a novelist and a short story writer, but you also have this digital presence. You know, you write about people working in TV. Do you feel like they are as different and as siloed as they once were?
I don't know. I don't know. I really don't. I'm not sure what to say there. Maybe ask me a different way.
Well, it's strange. You and I are the same age, and
congratulations.
We're halfway there to I don't know
Woo-hoo!
What.
We're halfway there to, you know, getting in a Corvette and going 90 down the highway just for fun.
Exactly. You know, I kind of think being old will be the most liberating thing in the world, assuming that you can be reasonably healthy.
Yes, my girlfriend says it's now or 90 about everything. I don't want to wear a sleeveless dress. Well, Helen, it's now or 90.
Right. Well, you know what? You have to think about it this way. No matter what you look like today, in 20 years, you will wish you looked 45.
That is right. It is as good as it gets right now.
When you were talking earlier about Dead Doorman, it seems like you are completely open to explaining the ideas behind your stories without any need to influence what a reader takes away from them. Like you say, well, I think maybe it's this. And I'm really curious about that perspective and if that's a factor of you not really caring what people think or simply just wanting people to experience these 100% through their own lens.
I want you to experience it the way you would experience one of my bacon-wrapped water chestnuts dipped in spicy mayonnaise sauce. You know, everybody's taste is different. I have been really surprised at how people have reacted. I've been surprised at who has reacted well to it. And when people say to me things like, oh, you write so much about the feminine, you know, woman's body so comfortably, or you've written a feminist manifesto, I say, thank you. But it was never really my intention.
Do you think of your audience as being primarily women?
I think of my audience being everybody, but I think it's maybe there's four straight men who would read it other than my husband. I think of my audience as women, definitely, all ages of women.
There is kind of a subversive humor, I think, that emerges when women who know each other well are together somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this collection brings some of that out. You know, you may be reading it alone, but it feels like they're, you know, you've got sisters and girlfriends sitting with you, sort of enjoying the same raised eyebrow.
Well, as you know, if you are married, you know, you always your husband goes out with a friend and you say, what did you talk about? Did you ask so-and-so about his divorce? Did you ask him about?
And they always say no, right?
They always say no. Right. I said, what did you talk about? The cheese fries. And so, you know, women talk and women are very, very open. My husband often says, did you tell your girlfriend that? Yes. anything that he doesn't want told, he has to say, please don't tell so-and-so that. But I probably will.
What are you reading while you are actively writing? Does that change the way you approach your consumption of books?
Yes, I read. I don't limit myself as to what I read. I read a lot of short story collections when I was working on this to study sort of how it was done. I hadn't written a short story since graduate school, and so I love reading short stories, and I read a lot of them over the years that I was this just to say, how does George Saunders do it? Mm-hmm. How does Lucy Wood do it? How does Laurie Moore do it? You know, and then how can I do it? So, yes, I read a lot.
What makes a short story more challenging than a novel?
Honestly, I find it easier.
Do you really?
I find writing a short story to be a joy. Dead Doorman took me 2 years to write. I kept rewriting it. That was the only hard one, and I'm very happy with the way that it turned out. But the other stories took, you know, 2 weeks and then, you know, a month or two of going back to revise. I wrote them mostly couched by poker tournaments. So I would say, okay, I'm going to get a draft done and then hand it over to my writing workshop before I go off to Las Vegas. And then I'll do a revision and hand that off before I go to Biloxi. And then I'll submit it to 20 places before I do this. So it's like a cupcake, making one little cupcake. It's delicious and instant gratification, in my experience.
But it sounds like that writing. One little cupcake is as much work as making a giant cake.
It is not.
Well,
it's not.
I've talked to people.
It's like I would say it's making a cupcake, and as opposed to making a 12-layer wedding cake. With tears and pearls and edible man and woman on top. You know, it's much harder to write a novel, at least for me, as proof where I wrote three that were never bought. So this was just like a little cupcake. Delicious.
Did it feel like coming home? Like, oh, this is what I was supposed to be doing all along.
It did. It was, I had my girlfriend in Florida used to say, oh, Helen, you know, I wish you would just write short stories, which I did in graduate school. And I got caught up with the thought of, but I'm supposed to be a novelist. That's how people will take me seriously. Hmm. And I want to win the Pulitzer and I want to be on the bestseller list and all those things that 24-year-olds think that I don't think at all anymore. I'm just happy to be invited to this party with my cupcake.
What happened to your relationships with other writers when maybe people that you associated with, people who were friends of yours, were having success and getting things published, and in those years when you were struggling, was it hard to see them?
You, I have been in a writer's workshop with two other women for 20 years. Hmm. Those are the writers Anne Napolitano, who wrote Within Arm's Reach and A Good Hard Look, and Hannah Tinty, who wrote Animal Crackers and The Good Thief. They are both successful, and we have both gone down very varied paths in our writing careers, but we have met regularly, once a month, twice a month, to have dinner, to workshop each other's pieces. And one of the greatest gifts that they gave to me when I wasn't writing was letting me, you know, continue to critique their work. Hmm. So it was that respect from those two women that also helped me keep going.
What does it take to critique the work of someone you care about very deeply in a way that is honest?
It can break your heart. It really does break my heart when I sit down with a piece of writing, because you want to, as a friend and a fan, say this is fantastic, but no first draft is fantastic.
Right.
And so I, as an editor, I think we all have changed our approach over the years, where 20 years ago the thought was, if you bring somebody in on the stretcher, a story with a broken leg, you don't compliment, you know, you say the leg is broken, you don't compliment the victim's eye makeup and dress.
Right.
And so we've been softening over the years a way of saying, you know, your leg is broken. It's hard. It's hard to be an honest critic, but that's what makes a relationship strong, is honesty and having someone you can trust to tell you the truth. And that writer's workshop has been a marriage for me for 20 years.
Is it harder to receive that criticism than to give it, or vice versa?
Nobody likes to have their feelings hurt.
Yeah.
But I'm at the point now, I think we all are at the point now after 20 years, where you want that opinion. You trust the other writers to tell you how to fix it. If something's not working, you have to have someone tell you how to fix it, and you know, you want it. You need somebody to shake you by the shoulders sometimes.
So I don't know for sure, but I would imagine that the kind of people you have to spend time with to keep your poker skills sharp. Those are different kinds of people than the people that you socialize with typically.
Yes.
What do you get from yes. those relationships?
Someone, you know, one of my girlfriends said to me when there was one of the blogs was following a tournament and they were showing pictures of players as they busted out of the tournament, deep in the tournament. And they said, Helen, you look like you're in a lineup of meth dealers.
So you don't wear a hoodie and dark glasses is what you're saying.
Absolutely not. I think if you're in a hoodie and sunglasses, that's a sign of cowardice. I come to the poker table like I am sitting right here in this studio in a skirt, in a blouse, full lipstick, and a smile. And it throws them. You know, once someone said to me, lady, do you always smile at people when you screw them? And I said, well, don't you like being smiled at when you're being screwed?
Is there anything else that you do when you're in Las Vegas or one of these places where you go for poker tournaments? Like, do you always get a massage or do you go shopping or what else do you do?
I like to go to the spas, and in Las Vegas, they are the best. You know, anywhere that simulates some sort of a rainforest experience, and I am there. I am there, and clothing optional. Delighted.
So tell me about your tour with this book. Was it something that you expected when you found out that you would be published, by Doubleday?
Absolutely not. The publishing industry has changed so much. Now everything's done on virtual tour. You do blogs, you do interviews, or you don't do much at all. People don't go on tour as much anymore. So the fact that I'm going on a tour is a great surprise and a great thrill. An even greater thrill is I'll be going to the UK and Australia on the book tour in February, thanks to my UK and Australian publishers, which is stunning to me. I never thought I would step foot in Australia. So I am very surprised at all the excitement that's happening. And I can't wait to come to Dallas because I want to see that exhibit before it closes.
Which exhibit? Oh, the
Pop.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm going to come early to snoop around.
Perfect. And let me ask you this. Do you have an alternative Twitter account that is also anonymous? Like, is there something besides what I do all day?
Wouldn't that be great? I do not. Not yet. I'll have to think about that. My husband wants me to do American Husband.
Oh.
but no. No, that's I don't have that many secrets. Not yet. I don't know. I'm trying to think of something to do for you, but
no, it's all right.
I'm pretty limited.
The new collection of short stories by Helen Ellis is called American Housewife. She will be at the Dallas Museum of Art Friday evening for Arts and Letters Live. Helen, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for making time for me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.